Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, how do people form beliefs? Is it strictly by rational processes or is something else responsible? Ken will be addressing that topic today with our guest, visiting scholar Dr. Steve Willing. Dr. Willing is a medical doctor, having completed his MD at the Medical College of Georgia, and he is an author. His book, Atlas of Neuroradiology, if I pronounce that correctly, has been used by many radiology trainees. Welcome to the program, Steve. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to meet you all again for the first time.
All right, Ken, well, as you know, we have had many visiting scholars here on the podcast. Tell us what we can look forward to today.
Very good. I want to have Steve tell us a little bit about his life and experience, but Stephen and I have been talking the last couple days about some of the pitfalls that come into reasoning. And so we're going to distinguish between things like intelligence and wisdom, and we'll talk about some of the ways that thinking breaks down, and he has some correctives that I think will be really interesting. So Steve, it's really good to have you with us. Thank you for participating in the Visiting Scholar Program and coming to be with us here on Straight Thinking. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for letting me come out. This is really exciting.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background. What is neuroradiology, and have you always been a physician? Did you move into academia? Give us a little summary of your professional experience.
Well, I entered medical school in 1976 at the Medical College of Georgia and had a fairly routine medical education there. Went on to University of Virginia and did a one-year internship in pediatrics. That was enough to convince me I probably didn't want to be a pediatrician the rest of my life. Being very much the geek and also very much the introvert, I found the perfect job for me, which was radiology, where basically one sits in a dark room looking at x-rays all day long. Although I'd have to say after 30 years, that did start getting a little tedious. After my radiology residency, I did a fellowship in neuroradiology from 1984 to 1985 at UAB in Birmingham. Now, neuroradiology is the subspecialty, the discipline that focuses on evaluating, interpreting, diagnosing disorders of the brain, the head and neck region, and the spine. I came in really at a perfect time. Starting in 1984, CT scanning had only been introduced about 5 years earlier to a significant degree, and it was only increasing in penetration during the last 2 years of medical school and then over the course of my residency. And MRI scanning didn't actually begin until about 1984, when I think the first clinical scanner went in. I remember when I was interviewing for radiology residencies, at the time, one of the sites I interviewed had a guest lecturer who was coming in and talking about this new technology called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. Mm. You now know it, of course, as MRI. And so I was privileged to enter at a time when I could see the whole trajectory of transformation. And of course, both CT and MRI tremendously revolutionized the diagnosis of disorders of brain and spine.
Oh yeah.
I like to use the analogy that just like the Bible can expose the innermost workings of our minds and our hearts, so the new imaging scanners can expose the innermost workings of our bodies.
Hmm. You know, Steve, a number of years ago I had a brain illness, and one of the technicians after an MRI showed me my brain on the screen. And we're going to talk a little bit about humility, but my first thought is I thought my brain would have been bigger. when I observed it. But you probably already guessed that about me.
Well, all they have to do is zoom up the image on the screen, and it can be instantly bigger.
I didn't know that. I would have appreciated that. Well, Steve, tell us a little bit about how you came to connect with RTB. How long have you known about RTB, and what was it that brought your interest in Reasons to Believe?
It goes back so far, I can barely remember the details. Of course, in my early childhood years, I started off as an atheist when I was in kindergarten, and then during the course of my education, became quite persuaded of evolution because that's what I was taught in junior high and high school. Interestingly, I heard some radio programs from a cult called the Worldwide Church of God that actually presented some pretty compelling challenges to evolution based on the complexity of life and the problem of design. I investigated it further and became quite skeptical at that point that evolution really had explanatory power for the origin of life and species. And then I started digging into this further and got some materials from the old Institute for Creation Research and went from an evolutionist to a young earth creationist, where I was fairly comfortable for about 20 years, or for about 10 years really, from about age 20 to about age 30. But I was never really committed to that viewpoint. They made a strong case that that's what the Bible taught and that there were issues. But I also experienced a lot of cognitive dissonance over it. I felt like too often they were really stretching to explain away some issues. Around 1985, 1986, I read a book. I think it was Genesis and the Age of the Earth, where it was explained that the interpretation of Genesis 1 was not limited to literal 24-hour time periods, that Yom could have any number of possible definitions. So one could be biblically orthodox, but not have to believe that somehow everything just popped into existence 6,000 years ago. And for me, that came as a tremendous relief.
Yeah,
I didn't have to be arm-twisted into believing it. I already had struggled with maintaining that level of belief, so it was tremendously liberating. My interest in that continued, and so in the early 1990s, I started noticing publications, books coming out from Hugh Ross and the ministry. I think I may have even heard Hugh Ross at my church, Briarwood, in Birmingham, Alabama, in the 1990s. But I know that I first heard Hugh Ross and Fuzz Run at Zionsville Presbyterian Church in Indianapolis around 1999 or 2000 when we had first just moved up there. My wife and I were both big fans. We got very engaged. We started supporting the ministry and getting the regular monthly CDs.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Aguirre's voice I recognize from way back. It's so distinctive and so mellow and relaxing, too. You have a very pleasant voice, Joe.
Don't fall asleep on us now.
So that's my background. I think it's an outstanding ministry. They're biblically faithful and scientifically faithful, and that's a hard combination to find in our society.
Well, thank you for that. Boy, it's encouraging to me. I must say it's encouraging to me, Joe and Dave, how many thoughtful people that are in the Visiting Scholar Program and the broader scholarly community that we have that are attracted to RTB. And Steve, we benefit by having people like you come, and we get to hear fresh minds and new ideas that are very meaningful to us.
A quick question. You mentioned Birmingham, Alabama. Also, we've heard Medical College of Georgia. And then you just said you were in Indianapolis. Maybe you could tell us about how you wound up at certain places. Was that driven by career or other or both or what?
Well, my training was in the Southeast, and generally one tends to stay in the same geographic region. So I finished my training, ended my fellowship at Birmingham in 1985. I got three very interesting offers when I finished. One was at University of Colorado in Denver. One was at the University of Louisville in Louisville, Kentucky. And then another one was in private practice somewhere. But the University of Louisville job was quite appealing. I enjoyed academics. I enjoyed the possibility of practicing my subspecialty at a time when neuroradiologists usually didn't get to do 100% neuroradiology. The department had just hired a new chairman from Mass General, and it had been a department that had been historically fairly weak that they were trying to build up and turn into a powerhouse. Well, it didn't exactly work out that way because our department chair went back to Boston after 18 months. After 5 years there, UAB recruited me back. Again, it was an academic situation. They were familiar with me. I was familiar with them, and it was a very comfortable fit. So I went down to UAB, and I was on the faculty there for 9 years. At that time, the department, at least my section, was experiencing a high turnover and turmoil, and this was sort of in the beginning of the internet revolution. Well, Indiana University was promising to develop a large informatics department, and I had a real interest in that area as well. So I was recruited up to Indiana University in 1999. I was on the faculty at IU for 6 years. Again, I had sort of a experience where 3 years after my arrival, five out of six of my section members had left for greener pastures. So there was, again, a very high turnover. And I ended up myself going into private practice in 2005 after 20 years in academics. I was at Indiana for 18 years and then just retired 2.5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Well, Steve, I want to talk with you a little bit about a subject you and I have been chatting a bit the last couple days. Straight thinking, of course, I think the central theme of our program is critical thinking, recognizing that ideas and beliefs, you need to approach them rigorously, that there's lots of fallacies, propaganda. It's easy to believe things that are not really rational. So let me kind of set the stage here, and then I want to ask you a few particular questions. Philosophers are, of course, often interested in epistemology. Episteme is the Greek word for knowledge. So how do we know what we know? How do we come to know it? How do we justify our beliefs and things of that nature? But it's interesting to me that beliefs can be based upon rational factors like logic and reason and evidence. They can contrastingly sometimes be based upon irrational factors, maybe propaganda or superstition or feelings. Not that feelings are bad, but maybe having no correspondence to rational elements. But then there's a third category that I think people are often unaware of, and that's what we call non-rational factors. They would be things like insight, imagination, kind of deeper elements. Blaise Pascal, for example, seems to talk about the idea that belief in God may be a non-rational factor before it's a rational factor, if you will. But you and I have chatted a little bit, and we've talked about things like when reasoning goes bad. We've talked a little bit about things like biases and propaganda. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this idea. You mentioned to me a book called The Intelligence Trap. And you distinguish between intelligence and wisdom. So could you unpackage some of your concerns about the lack of clarity in reasoning and things of that nature?
The Intelligence Trap is by a science writer named David Robson. It just came out in the UK in March and isn't even going to be released in the US until August. This is 2019 when we're speaking right now. So it'll be coming out this summer. It was a brilliant book. I got hold of it through the Amazon UK store and read it on the Kindle. And he begins, if I may, with a story of a certain Nobel Prize winner, Carrie Mullis. It's okay to use his name because he broadcasts this on his website and through his books. Carrie Mullis describes how when he was in New Mexico, he was abducted by glowing aliens who resembled raccoons with dark beady eyes.
Wow.
He believes that AIDS is not caused by the HIV virus and that astrology has extraordinary potential for curing mental illness. He also believes that humans can travel the galaxy by projecting themselves across astral planes. Carrie Mullis is also a Nobel Prize winner for discovering the polymerase chain reaction that's used to replicate DNA. So this is sort of an introduction to the idea that extremely intelligent people believe crazy things. I shared with you a quote yesterday of a very well-known genius, probably one of the brightest minds of the 20th century, who expressed an unshakable faith in Vladimir Lenin, the terrorist founder of the Soviet Union, responsible for the deaths of 20 million lives through him and his successor. This gentleman expressed that he would probably be looked down as one of the great heroes of humanity. And of course, the author of that quote was Albert Einstein. So
bright people can believe crazy things.
In fact, science writers are familiar with this, and they've coined a phrase calling it the Nobel disease.
Oh, boy. Look out for that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about theologians sometimes talk about what we call the noetic effects of the fall, that sin has affected our entire being. And sometimes sin has real effect on the way we think. I'm thinking here of Romans 1, for example, that it appears that we have a direct knowledge of God, and yet we're able to suppress that knowledge of God. And Scripture also talks about other ways in which sin affects the human mind. You've just mentioned that even brilliant people, I mean, Time magazine gave Albert Einstein Man of the Century because he changed the way we look at the universe. People with lots of education can still come to very difficult things to believe. Are you proposing that people are not always as rational as they think they are?
Well, you mentioned two things. One is the noetic effect of the fall, and the other is that people are not being rational. Ideally, we think that all of our beliefs are based on facts, logic, and experience, that you simply take the facts in front of you, you think clearly, and you come to a perfectly rational decision. Mostly that's an illusion, because first of all, we can really never know all the facts. Well, I shouldn't say never. I mean, your own personal day-to-day existence, which you personally witness, you usually can get it right. But we never have perfect information. We never have perfect thought process. But more important than either of those is just the sheer number of decisions that we have to make on a daily basis. The mountains of evidence that we'd have to go through, the huge array of opinions that we form on an almost endless range of topics. Nobody has the ability to research all those, to look at all the evidence, and to analyze it objectively. So we come up with shortcuts. These are mental tricks that we use, and that's the field of heuristics, H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C-S, heuristics. That's not some fancy trick for mental thinking. It's something we do automatically. It simply describes how we can make decisions, how we can function. And it's not a flaw, it's a feature. God made us with the ability to think quickly on our feet, because a lot of times that instantaneous decision could be the difference between life and death. But it also leads to laziness, because serious thought is a lot of effort. A lot of times we may resort to heuristics when we really should be investing a little more time. Daniel Kahneman, who got the Nobel Prize for economics for his research in heuristics and cognitive biases, split our thinking into two types of thinking. The system one is the fast, effortless, heuristic thinking. It's thinking from the gut, whereas system two is the slow, analytical, contemplative sort of thinking. Now, that's the first part. But the second part is the effect of the fall. Well, what happens when we take our fallenness and apply it to thinking? Well, there are a couple of consistent influences, but most of those center around self. We can use this thinking. Our thinking is consistently biased in a certain direction, and it's biased in a direction for our own self-interest, to make ourselves look good, to make us feel good about ourselves, to signal our group identity, to achieve acceptance and popularity, to signal loyalty to your own peer group. And because of these motivations that originate from the fall, essentially the sin of pride, that drives us, it influences our thinking in ways far beyond what God would have originally wanted.
I have a question. Excuse me, Ken. A typical example, I read your blog post. It's the Soggy Spaniel is the place where you write. But I saw a blog post on Richard Dawkins. So that's, I think, an example of what you're talking about. I think a lot of people would hold him in high regard, and probably that accent doesn't hurt. But people look to him as one of those people that speaks eloquently against the arguments of Christianity. But you've identified some flaws there. Maybe you can talk about that.
Well, Dawkins came out with The God Delusion in 2006, so it's been 13 years ago now, but he's still considered one of the foremost atheist polemicists, and that book still stands out. I really had very little interest in reading it, but because of my interest in this particular area, I thought it would be valuable to see how a mind works that operates very differently from my own. And to make it even worse, I was listening to it as an audiobook, which was read by Richard Dawkins. Wow. And that adds a whole depth of intensity besides what it would be from reading a paper book where I could just set it aside. And what's very striking as I went through the first four chapters was the level of emotional intensity behind it all. I mean, this is not just a cold, reasoned, dispassionate analysis of something he intellectually disagrees with. This is a polemic against something he genuinely hates, that he feels very emotionally intense about. Another thing that was striking was the intense moralism of the whole thing. He doesn't simply believe Christianity and religion is wrong. He believes Christianity is evil. And because of that, it allows him to justify in his own mind the spite, the venom, the insulting, condescending tone that he adopts towards all believers. And yes, along the way, I found a few major logical errors in what I thought was his calculation for the improbability of God.
You know, what's interesting about that, I think, for me, is I often contrast even the new atheist and the old atheist. Let's go back, for example, just to the time of C.S. Lewis. Lewis died almost 56 years ago. It seems to me the atheist in his time They knew more about Christianity, probably because they grew up in an educational system that kind of forced them to know something about the faith. But it seems to me that atheists like J.L. Mackey, A.J. Eyre, Jean-Paul Sartre, etc., they not only knew about Christianity, but it aided them in their skepticism because they knew some of the vulnerabilities. They knew the soft spots. But I think that they were also given to more rational debate. Whereas with the new atheists, so I'm speaking of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Dan Dennett, and others who have kind of followed in that sphere. Personally, I don't find them to be very knowledgeable about Christianity. It's not like they've really taken the time to think through the Christian worldview. And often, and I read Dawkins' book as well a number of years ago, it seems more ad hominem. It seems more a kind of emotional attack, if you will. I make that contrast just to simply propose that I find the old atheists more formidable. It's when they critique Christianity, I can tell that they've thought about it and they know some of the better sources. And that's not to say that there aren't philosophers today who are atheists who are much more rational in their approach, but it is very interesting with Dawkins that you see this idea that he not only thinks Christianity is false, but he doesn't like it.
Absolutely. Well, you can speak with far greater authority on the old atheists because I'm not nearly as well studied in that area as you, but what is striking is the level of emotional intensity in Dawkins. And emotions strongly influence what we believe and how we believe. Now, that's not uniformly bad. It can be bad. It can be good. But when we're going to talk about the rules for thinking, the first rule here is at least be aware of your emotions, identify them, and consider to what degree they may be affecting your own personal beliefs.
Ken, I have a question. I don't know if it's going to relate directly here, but perhaps it will. Going through my mind, I have a couple of terms that you've brought to our attention a number of times on this podcast, homo religiosus and homo rationalis. I'm mispronouncing those, but I wonder what bearing those ideas have on what we're talking about now. You can probably introduce the question I have here a little bit better.
Yeah, Steve and I have talked many times that human beings seem to be, at their very nature, religious. And so homo religiosus would be religious man. And then, of course, in kind of a philosophical context, we talk about human beings being rational. Aristotle thought that the distinguishing thing that separated humans from the beasts, if you will, was their fundamental rationality. I think Aristotle would have accepted something like human exceptionalism, for example. But and so, Joe, your question in that context is are human beings as religious as we think? Are they as rational as we
think? Yes, because I think what we're getting at is some people think they're entirely rational, and that's going to get us to the promised land, whatever that is in their minds. Maybe you can address that, Steve.
Sort of like the Star Trek future universe where all people are completely rational in peace and tranquility. That automatically almost sounds like a setup for a false dilemma. Are people rational? Sometimes. Are they religious by nature? It would appear that way. You know, we might think, well, we talk about, it's often said we live in the age of skepticism. Well, what does skepticism mean? We have extremely high levels of belief nowadays in astrology, UFOs, alien abductions, crystals, quantum healing. Deepak Chopra sells millions and millions of books peddling total nonsense. So in terms of people having a consistent materialistic worldview, that's certainly not the situation. Or how else would you define skepticism? I think a better and more productive definition of skepticism is simply demanding a high level of evidence for anything you accept as fact, or at least highly probable. And again, we seem to fall short. A lot of that is because of the action of confirmation bias, something that was described many decades ago and falls into the category of biases well described by Kahneman and Tversky. Confirmation bias is the tendency to perceive and have regard for only that evidence that supports your preferred or pre-existing opinions. So whatever our opinion is, we go looking for evidence that supports it and then tend to dismiss the evidence that contradicts it. Now, people learn about confirmation bias, and smart people realize that that's a pitfall, so they have to go an extra mile by introducing what we call disconfirmation bias. Disconfirmation bias is the reverse. It's applying a much higher level of scrutiny to that evidence that contradicts your pre-existing opinion. So it's quite complex. I mean, people can be rational, but usually they can be rational when it's in their interest and they want to be. But when they want a different outcome, then rationality is probably not that high on the table.
Well, go ahead, Dave.
Well,
jump in.
You brought up this question of, you know, what I agree with you call nonsense that some people believe, some people, very bright people, Nobel Prize winners, believe what we would consider nonsense. But I engage with a lot of different people in my scientific involvement at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And one atheist in particular would say the same thing about my Christianity. He would say, all those things that you said about UFOs and things of that nature, he would say that I have the same kind of beliefs in things that are nonsense. How do you respond to that?
Well, first we have to make sure that's not true, because it's been my experience that a lot of Christians are willing to accept nonsense. So let's be intellectually consistent. But if he's specifically talking about the foundational beliefs of Christianity, he doesn't have a strong case for that, because I base my faith on historic evidence, the resurrection of Christ, the reliability of the Gospels, particularly the New Testament. We base our belief in Christianity especially on history. Now, a single historical event can't be falsified or proved by science alone. You have to go on the historical record, and the historical record is abundant that Jesus really did live, and there's no better explanation other than his resurrection. So I think when the skeptics come at us, it really has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. We believe in creation. Well, they have no better explanation. Penrose and Hawking settled the argument for all time when they established that not just space and matter and energy, but even time began with the Big Bang. There is no explanation for that. There is no before when time began at the Big Bang. Talking about before the Big Bang becomes nonsense when you're outside of our timeline. They don't have an explanation for that. You have to assume that there is something greater that had the ability to bring that into existence, and God is the best explanation for solving the fallacy of infinite regress. They come back and say, well, who made God? Well, that's an equivocation fallacy, because God, by definition, is uncreated. Therefore, if they say who created God, they're forcing us to change our definition, which we don't have to do.
Stephen, I want to come back to some of the biases and the pitfalls of thinking, but before I address that topic. I was at an apologetic conference. This is called the ISCA conference, the International Society for Christian Apologetics. And one of the speakers distinguished two types of atheists, and I thought it was very interesting. One of the atheists that he talked about was Thomas Nagel, who I would put as an atheist today, but not the new atheist. This guy is, I think, a top-notch philosopher. But the contrast that was made by the speaker, and I think it was a Southern Baptist philosopher, and I don't recall his name, but he talked about the idea that some atheists find Christian theism to be rational, but not attractive. And other atheists find Christianity to be irrational, but attractive. And I was very interested in that idea. So Thomas Nagel, who is he is a philosopher at New York University. He is interested in the mind. He is a close friend of Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga. But it seems that Thomas Nagel finds Christianity to have a level of rationality to it. He doesn't think that Christian theists, for example, are irrational. He's not convinced by the evidence, the data that people present, but he doesn't want that God to exist. He says that quite explicitly, that not only do I not believe in God, but I don't want there to be a God. I don't want that to be the ultimate nature of reality. I wonder if you would comment about this idea that sometimes people find Christianity fairly rational, but they're not attracted to it. They're really turned off by it. And yet there are other people who would say the opposite. They kind of like the idea that there would be an infinite, eternal, maximally perfect God, but they just can't believe it because they just don't think reason is there for it. Any comments about that kind of contrast?
Well, you talk about two different situations, those who think it's plausible but don't want to believe, and those who would like to believe but think it's implausible. So which one do I talk about first? Well, Nagel, I've seen that quote where he says, I don't want there to be a God. And I mean, I could say that that's exhibit A for the contention that beliefs are often emotionally based. There's been an abundant amount of research in the last 20 years finding that what we believe is heavily influenced by emotions. It's one of the four big non-rational factors we talked earlier about: facts, experience, and logic or reasoning. But there are four other categories that are hugely influential in how we decide, how we choose our beliefs. Those would be emotions, tradition, peer influences, and heuristics. Well, we talked about heuristics briefly, but emotions are a major factor. Some say perhaps the deciding factor. Equally, peer influences, whether it's to conform to our own peer group, to be popular, to be accepted, or whether they actually persuade us through rational means. I guess I could say with Nagel, at least he's being honest, but you have to question, well, why does he want it? You have to dig deeper in. But that's a very reasonable thing to do. And maybe we spend too much time debating the logic and not spending enough time talking about the emotional issues that push people for or against Christianity.
You know, it's interesting to me that when I first started doing apologetics professionally, so I'm going back more than 30 years now, when I would go to the colleges and universities and give talks to both students and faculty, predominantly the questions I got were relating to, is Christianity true? Does God exist? Did Jesus rise from the dead? Mostly those types of questions. I would say, however, often when I go to the university and colleges now, they don't ask me those questions. Sometimes they do. Often they'll ask me, is Christianity good? Moving from, let's say, for example, is Christianity rational to, is Christianity attractive? Is it something I really want to believe in? And I have asked myself the question, in apologetics, are we heavy-handed in looking at the question of is Christianity rational, and maybe not taking enough time, like I think Tolkien, Lewis, people of that nature, who spent time talking about the attractiveness of affirming Christianity. And so I wonder if Lewis would maybe critique us by saying we need more imagination in our apologetics, not just reason.
I rather think he would, although it's hard, I guess, always to make sweeping statements because you always might find somebody somewhere who is addressing the issue. But in another sense, I think we need to be absolutely mindful of that simply addressing the rational, logical evidences without addressing the morality and the emotional aspect of it is truly leaving our rear flank undefended.
Yeah.
And is Christianity good? I mean, that's not a simple, straightforward question to answer, because if you look at history, the record is mixed. We have to be honest with that. And it's very hard to approach history without any biases. Because of confirmation bias, people tend to find what they look for. You can find abundant evidence in history, if you want, that Christianity was really bad. But then a defender would say, well, when you actually look at it, a lot of times it was really the state corrupting Christianity. There's an old myth, sort of a grammar school view of history, that the Catholic Church was all powerful. But I've studied medieval history, and that's clearly not the situation. In fact, we probably benefited because church and state were generally separated, and often they were competing power influences. They talk about the Holy Roman Emperor. I don't remember the number. There are so many Henrys. There were French Henrys and English Henrys and Holy Roman Emperor Henrys, but one of the Henrys, famous over the investiture controversy, who was going to be excommunicated by the Pope and famously went to the Pope and spent several days in the snow waiting for permission. And well, that shows that the church was so powerful. What they omit was a couple decades later, he was moving in with his army and captured and took the Pope hostage. So that there was a lot of push and pull in that. Mm-hmm. We can twist history to prove whatever we want, but there is an incredible amount of goodness. I mean, Christianity probably is responsible for the prosperity and the freedom and the technology, the healthcare that we have, all the benefits of civilization that we enjoy. They blame Christians for supposedly abusing Native Americans, but the Catholic Church was at times vigorously opposed and resisted abuse of the natives by the secular governments and invading armies. So it was very much a mixed bag. I mean, the first great missionary wasn't a Protestant. It was Francis Xavier and the Jesuits. They led the Christian world in bringing the benefits of civilization and freedom to other societies. Christianity led the world in bringing literacy through Wycliffe. So Christianity's done a lot of good. There was a notable column in the London press a few years ago written by a British atheist that wrote what Africa needs today is Christianity. He'd spent time traveling around Africa, and he found that wherever Christianity had been entrenched, that people had become more peaceable, that tribalism was on the wane, that prosperity and the general hallmarks of social welfare were on the upswing. And I've been going to Kenya every year since 2006, serving at Tenwick Hospital, founded by World Gospel Mission in the 1950s. And it's one of the great privileges that I get to enjoy working with the people I admire most. These are staffed by American missionary physicians who have given up extremely lucrative careers, living comfortable lives, enjoying all the material benefits of Western society, and they choose to go live in Kenya, providing uncompensated health care to Africans, and not simply as a charity, but it's a disciple-making, civilization-building endeavor. They're actively involved in training the next generation of African physicians to go out and care for their own people, to become self-supporting. So, like I said, it's how you want to perceive it. There's Christianity does do a lot of good, but someone who's committed to find the opposite, they can go out and do that. I'll concede that.
Well, let's come back to this idea of biases, blind spots, if you will. Stephen, I think the greatest philosophical story ever told was Plato's cave. So you have men who are born in the cave, and they're looking at the back wall, and they think they're seeing reality, but actually it's shadows cast by a fire that burns behind them. Then one day, one of the men who's chained in the cave, they get out, and their eyes see a whole new world, a sun up there and a whole reality. The man returns to let his friends know that they're in bondage, in darkness. They don't see reality as they think they do. And of course, they want to kill him for doing that. And some people have suggested that's not all that different than Socrates, who is trying to tell the Athenians, give them wisdom. Not all that different than Christ, who comes to tell us that we're in chains and in darkness and to reveal his Father's truth. I have discovered, and I'm going to use myself as an example, I'm aware of confirmation bias. I'm also aware of things like groupthink. And I notice the older I get, the more I like to be around people who agree with me, largely. And so one of the ways I try to combat that is I want to make sure I'm hearing other voices. Now, I don't listen to just any voice. Somebody has to demonstrate that they're well worth listening to. But there are times where I will specifically ask myself, have I considered the best argument on the other side? You know, I hold a particular political philosophy, but while I'm uncomfortable at times listening to other people who have very different approaches to politics, I try to go looking for people that hold a different point of view than I do, but yet who are rational, who are careful, and I'll listen to them. And I often challenge my students to do the same thing. You know, when I teach a course at Biola University and they write a term paper, I'll say, you know, write, if it's on ethics or it's on comparative religions, go ahead and make your case. But I want you to tell me at the end, what do you think is the very best argument against your position? And how would you then respond to that? So in terms of confirmation bias, that I might go looking for people who agree with me, what are things that you can do to defend against those blind spots? I know you mentioned cognitive reflection. What is that, and how can it help us?
Cognitive reflection has been described, I think, for about the last 10 to 15 years. Interest in these areas especially surfaced after the 2008 financial crisis, when people started to analyze and say, well, what lessons can be learned out of all this? When the book comes out, The Intelligence Trap, I think anyone who wants to really learn about this can read in depth, because it treats this very well. But I talked earlier about Kahneman, the System 1 and System 2. Cognitive reflection is a conscious effort to engage System 2. That's not a complete definition, but it is a partial definition, that you slow down, you think about it. Don't go with your gut when the matter demands more serious consideration. But also important, a very important element of this is considering alternatives. Thinking outside, just simply admitting that you might be mistaken or might be wrong, which is intellectual humility. I'll share you a little version I have, you talked about Plato's cave and the man that came in and said, this is different. There's a famous saying that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Now, that quote is attributed to Erasmus, who was an unrepentant humanist. I think Erasmus was wrong. I think more likely in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man would be burned as a witch. Mm-hmm. That's probably a more accurate representation of human nature. That aside.
Now, I want you to talk just briefly about a couple other things that are kind of correctives. What is open-minded thinking?
I talked about heuristics and how we have these very efficient ways of thinking. One of the things that we do is thinking in boxes. They're called schemas, is the technical psychological term. But it's compartmentalized thinking. People are complex. It's too challenging to look upon every person as a unique individual, although that's what we should do. Instead, we think of them in terms of categories. He's friendly. Oh, he's obnoxious. Oh, he's rude. We put these little categories and labels on people. But that's just an example. We also do these with more abstract concepts. The classic little cliche is thinking outside the box, but that's calling it a cliche, it often gets trivialized, but it's really something very crucial. That's what actively open-minded thinking is all about.
How about your idea of growth mindset? What does that involve?
In The Intelligence Trap, he talks about growth mindset and differentiates that from a fixed mindset. And this is really interesting and I think inspiring for all of us. A fixed mindset, for instance, says that I'm as good as I will ever be. I don't need to grow. I probably can't grow. Whereas the growth mindset says, I don't have to accept the status quo. If I have a low view of my intelligence, I don't have to settle for that. I can learn. I can broaden my horizons. A fixed mindset keeps making the same mistakes over and over again. A growth mindset looks upon every mistake as an opportunity to learn, to reflect, look back, say, what could I have done differently? And when they actually investigate, look at these people, they find that those with a growth mindset tend to become happier, healthier, more successful, just better adjusted individuals.
You also mentioned consistent skepticism. I talk with skeptics and atheists. More and more it is online, social media. Sometimes I ask them, how skeptical are you of your skeptical beliefs? You know, they always want to challenge my religious views. I like to return the favor and say, are you skeptical of your skepticism? What does it mean to be a consistent or have consistent skepticism?
Simplest definition is simply require the same level of evidence for any truth claim you embrace. Probably the most famous or best known skeptic in the U.S. is Michael Shermer, who's a fairly consistent skeptic, but Michael Shermer accepts evolution as established fact. Now as you all well know, there's no existing model for the origin of life. It's a complete mystery. I mean, that is a hole that you could pilot a Death Star through without scraping the sides. So I would say that Michael Shermer is actually very credulous with respect to evolution. He doesn't have to believe creation, but he should be skeptical of something that has such a glaring hole in its infrastructure. Michael Shermer would say that I'm credulous by believing a creation God, but then I'm highly skeptical of an unsubstantiated claim that's the bedrock of the theory.
But there's a book that I came across recently. In fact, I gave it to my atheist friends, and its title is How to Be an Atheist. And it's written by a philosopher, Mitch Stokes. I don't know, he's somewhere, I think he was a student of Plantinga, Christian philosopher. But he's addressing that very issue that you're talking about here, that people, if they really want to be an atheist, an honest atheist, they've got to have equal skepticism towards those things that they're inclined to believe and not just those things that they don't want to believe.
And in fact, very, very few people actually fall into that category. I think if we were able to dig down, the overwhelming majority of people who were skeptical of Christianity would embrace any number of alternative beliefs that are far more incredible than what we embrace.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's close on a biblical point. The Bible talks about pride. The Bible says that Lucifer became the devil by pride. Scripture says that God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. What does humility involve when it comes to the intellectual life? I mean, I often think that skeptics are right. There are a lot of Christians who don't care a great deal about the life of the mind, learning, reflecting. But what does an intellectually humble life look like?
Boy, that's a challenging question, Ken. Let me start from the other direction. What can pride do to influence our thinking? And the first and perhaps the most insidious is just being satisfied with what we are, going back to the issue of the growth mindset. As Christians, we're called to a lifetime of growth. We're not called to a static existence. We're called to a process of sanctification, which is increasing in maturity. So a Christian doesn't have the option of just being static in any aspect of their life. Pride makes us very comfortable with how we are, makes us very comfortable with our level of understanding, with our existing wisdom. And if you're very comfortable, then there's really no incentive to read. There's no incentive to broaden your horizons, to expand your knowledge. And that's a very dangerous situation, but what is it? Is it pride? It could be laziness, but it, again, pride may be the idea that justifies our laziness. Whatever it is, we become very satisfied. The other danger that pride can lead to is overconfidence, and of course, that's where the intellectual humility comes in. You know, there may be definitions of pride, but if you had to reduce pride to a single word, it would be overconfidence. Now, it could be overconfidence in our abilities, overconfidence in our importance, or overconfidence in our control over life and the situations around us. But in the life of the mind, it's overconfidence in our own beliefs. And that's a very rampant problem, I think, both inside and outside of Christianity. And as Christians, we have to set the example. It does no good to say to a Richard Dawkins, you're arrogant, when we adopt the same mindset. And I think we need to be cautious and humble. What intellectual humility, more than anything else, is simply accepting the possibility that you might be wrong. Now, we need to hold our ground on the doctrines of the faith. They're defensible. They're validated by 2,000 years of history, and we have good rational arguments behind that. But Christians adopt a lot of peripheral views that aren't foundational to the faith and that aren't based on good, reasonable, logical, or historic grounds. And merely having the belief isn't the problem. It's when they believe that they're infallible, that that belief is unassailable. For example, some in the Christian community adhere to a particular interpretation of Genesis that we find inconsistent with science. Now, the problem isn't they believe that. The problem is that they think everybody else is wrong. They think that they can't possibly be wrong in that exegesis. And that's where I think you cross the line into intellectual pride. So how would you fix that? The attitude of intellectual humility would simply be to admit, well, yes, there are other points of view, and they may be valid.
Steve, tell us a little bit about your family.
Well, I have a grown son named Jonathan, who is a chemical engineer in Houston, Texas. My wife, Stuart, had a career in informatics. Now she's been working towards a nutrition degree. She's a longtime supporter of Reasons to Believe. She grew up at Briarwood Presbyterian Church in Birmingham, Alabama, and they've been trying to get out here for 3 days, having flights been delayed by storms in Houston. Then I have a 14 or almost 14-year-old son, Patrick, who we've been homeschooling since I retired, who will be coming out as well. He's really into the Avengers and Marvel Universe.
Oh. All right. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us here on Straight Thinking, and thank you for your very thoughtful approach to these issues. We really appreciate you joining us.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Very good.
All right. That's going to wrap it up for this podcast. You can check out Dr. Stephen Willing's blog site as well. It's called The Soggy Spaniel. Did I have that right?
Soggy Spaniel.
Must be a dog story in there somewhere.
You have to see the picture up on the banner.
All right, so you can check that out. Be sure to check out Ken's place as well, reflectionsbyken.wordpress.com, where you'll find Ken's writings once a week in addition to this weekly podcast. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.